Coming up on Weekend America.
Wall Street is closed today, but everyone's talking about what went on this week. Bankruptcies, rush sales, bailouts, panics, roller coaster stock market, help! As the madness pauses, we'll explore exactly what it means to you. I'm John Moe. Also this hour, politics can get kind of abstract, but at the truck stop, it's real.
Well, we need to get something with health care. Canada does it. Mexico does it. There's got to be some reason that these other countries can do it. Why can't we?
We grab representatives from the Obama and McCain campaigns and sit them down with long-haul drivers. And Billy just loves Saturday morning cartoons.
The opening theme to Looney Tunes' Merry Melody cartoons is kind of like a Star-Spangled Banner for a lot of children of my generation.
Oh, by the way, Billy is a two-time U.S. Poet Laureate. Grab a bowl of sugar-frosted chocolate bombs and join us for Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Oh, we're recuperating from a crazy week on Wall Street. We'll talk about all that. And we're going all around the country this hour, talking to your friends and neighbors. We're going to a truck stop outside Phoenix to talk politics with the guys in the big rigs. To California to walk with an ex-prisoner as he tastes freedom for the first time in 20 years. Plus, former poet laureate Billy Collins talks Saturday morning cartoons. Really? Also, the not-so-idyllic life of a cruise ship entertainer. Where would you like to take a cruise to?
I'd probably go to Taiwan because that's where I was born and I want to visit my homeland.
We want to take an Alaskan cruise and leave all the children at home.
I would go to Mexico on a cruise because I love the culture, the food especially.
I understand most of the cruise ships, you go and eat yourself into a stupor, and that sounds like a good thing to me.
I would not go on a cruise ship because I've been there and I've done that and I wish someone had given me cliff notes. It was a dinky boat out of a bad port to a bad location with a bad crew and nothing but margarita pizzas and beer, tea, and drink.
Aside from that, how was it? Those voices came from Concord, New Hampshire, Charleston, West Virginia, and Birmingham, Alabama. Well, a cruise sounds kind of nice right now. Actually, after this week, the events on Wall Street seem like something from a movie. High drama, tension, a last-minute rescue effort at the end of the week by Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, who stepped in to try to address the mess. The Dow was actually up for the week. A high note, but not necessarily a happy ending. So what does it really mean for you and your family? Chris Farrell is American Public Media's chief economic correspondent. He's had a long week, and we brought him in on his day off. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
So I got to ask you, same question everybody's probably been asking you all week. Chris, how safe is my money?
Your money this weekend is safer than it was last weekend.
Okay.
And the reason for that is the federal government has made a number of extraordinary actions, one of which is the U.S. taxpayer, you and I, essentially are backstopping the entire money market mutual fund industry, $3.5 trillion, so we don't get a run there. And then this morning, the White House delivered to Congress a $700 billion proposal in order to rescue the American financial system.
And that's the plan that they're spending, that Congress is spending all this weekend hashing out, negotiating.
That's right. And what the plan will do is that it's raised the debt limit so that we don't run into any problems there. We're going to all learn about this process called reverse auctions. In a reverse auction, you try and get the assets at the lowest possible price. But if you boil it down, what the federal government is going to do, what the U.S. taxpayer is going to do, is take all these toxic mortgages out of the U.S. financial system and put them in a separate entity.
Okay. Question number two, hysterically asking, everybody probably asking you in the hallways this week, will I ever be able to retire?
That seems to be the dominant question that I've been getting, yes. And sometimes with black humor and sometimes with a little bit of anger. Is
depending
this
on
fault?
The age, probably.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely depending. And age does matter. Your time horizon really is important. If you have a reasonable time horizon, we're talking 10 to 20 years, you'll get through this okay. And by the way, if you're 55 years old and you look at average life expectancy, I mean, you have another 20 to 30 years to live. So you don't want to be doing anything with panic. And that's the bottom line message. You don't want to do anything to panic. But at the same time, you want to go through and hedge your portfolio against risk. You want to make sure that the money that you have will be there tomorrow. But for those of you who have a well-diversified portfolio, I know it's an ugly expression, but if you have that well-diversified portfolio, you'll get through this, take some lessons, and then you can get more conservative later on.
Now, like a lot of people, I like to think that I've been playing by the rules and living relatively within my means.
Of course you have.
Of course I have. But other larger institutions, sounds like they haven't been. This isn't fair, is it, that we're bailing these people out?
It is not fair.
Thank you.
It is completely unfair. And you know what? Life isn't fair. It's the nature of the beast. This is the mother of all bailouts. But with any bailout, it is unfair. With a bailout, you have bad outcomes, worse outcomes, the worst outcome. Worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. You stare at the abyss, and you're going to bail out a lot of irresponsible people in order to prevent an economy from tumbling into a Great Recession.
Mm. So what have we learned this week?
Well, what we learned this week, just taking a look at the individual, is you really do have to manage your portfolio, your money conservatively. You know, all those bromides that your mother used to tell you that would drive you crazy. You
she
know?
Used to say life isn't fair also.
Exactly. You know what? It turns out she was right.
Okay. Well, good luck, Chris, this week, and good luck following the events of this weekend. Sounds like nobody really has a weekend off this week.
Well, I think you had the most profound comment in summarizing the week.
Yeah. Whew. Phew. Chris Farrell is American Public Media's chief economic correspondent. Thanks, Chris. Well, Barack Obama and John McCain have both been trying to adjust their campaigns to the economic news, explain how they'll make things better. The economy is a big issue on voters' minds this time around, of course, along with health care, the war, education. Over the next 6 weekends, we want to take you to places where some of those issues are part of everyday life, away from the TV studios and pundits and newspapers and blogs, to where people are really living these issues and not just talking about them. We're calling the series Politics on the Spot, and our first spot is a truck stop on the road west from Phoenix to Los Angeles. Reporter Renee Gattel takes us there.
Liberty Fuel is an independent truck stop off Interstate 10. They have bays of gas pumps in front and diesel stations in the back for the trucks. In between is a cavernous convenience store with all the usual sodas, slushies, candy, and beef jerky. Trucker Jesse Cerno walks inside, opens his wallet, and peels off 15 $20 bills. That's all he has right now to get his load of scrap metal to Southern California.
319. 19.
Cerna goes outside and over to his massive white truck and starts to pump.
Now I'm just going to put my gloves on. Don't want to get dirty.
Cerna has to pay all his fuel costs up front, and then it can take up to a month for him to get reimbursed. And he says work is harder to come by.
I've personally had 15 friends give up the truck. I've had friends call me crying if they can borrow money, but of course I couldn't because I'm in the same boat myself. I got a friend who called the other day, said he came home to no lights, no water, and it's very horrible, and all we're doing is trying to work and survive.
He says he's voting for Democrat Barack Obama because he says the country needs to change direction. But at the same time, Cerna says he doesn't feel like either presidential candidate is speaking to him.
I wish they would mention something about truckers, what they would do to help us, because otherwise, honest to God, we're here by ourselves. By ourselves.
The diesel pump clicks off.
A 300 only gave me 77 gallons, but it'll get me to where I need to go.
And with that, he gets in his cab and pulls off. After 2 days of talking to drivers, I invited representatives of the two major political parties to come to the truck stop. We sit at a table at the Wendy's fast food restaurant connected to the travel center. Emily DeRose is the spokeswoman for the Arizona Democrats. She's in jeans, with her hair pulled back in a neat ponytail. Camilla Strongen is the spokeswoman for the Arizona Republicans. She has a blonde bob and is wearing a trendy gray cotton dress. She says to get fuel prices back under control, the government needs to have all options on the table.
We need to do everything we possibly can, which means using all our own natural resources as well as looking to new technology and helping to stimulate R&D so that there's not one solution to this problem. It's multi-level.
This is Emily. As for Democrats, one of the first things that you'll see is that Senator Obama would give families a $1,000 tax credit to help them pay for some of these outrageous energy prices. And he would use money from oil companies that have been making astronomic profits to help families pay for the fuel prices that they're looking at now.
Did you want to respond to that?
Absolutely. What she fails to tell you is that his rebate is really, you know, all about increasing the expenses on gas companies, which we consumers are going to feel that. They raise their prices. It's just a circular issue that's going to come back.
Without meaning to, I had set up a mini presidential debate. Really buzz phrases like tax credits and working families are ping-ponging around the Wendy's. Camilla attacks Obama's stance on drilling.
Offshore drilling is something that Senator Obama has really flip-flopped on as far as where he stands, and I'm not even sure what his position is today.
Well, let me interrupt Camilla again and say John McCain was opposed to offshore drilling until June, when millions of dollars from oil company lobbyists started pouring into his campaign. So, Renee, you look like you have something to say.
My head is starting to spin a bit as you guys go back and forth with your facts. So I drag the two spokesladies outside. We go to the diesel pumps out back and run into trucker Larry Melvin from Muskogee, Oklahoma. With a long, scraggly goatee, Melvin looks like he'd be at home at a ZZ Top concert. He's holding two ice-cold cans of Red Bull.
How much did you put in your tank today?
$600.
So how much is that a week?
$3,000 a week in fuel.
When do you get reimbursed for that?
30 days down the road.
You have to front all of it?
I have to front everything.
That's incredible.
Democrat Emily DeRose seems surprised. But Melvin, he's not impressed with either political party.
They're lost in their own actions. They don't care what's going on for the people. They just they're out for their own gain.
Can I ask you if you're registered to vote?
Melvin nods to Camilla that yes, he is registered, but says he's undecided. So Emily jumps in.
What are the issues that you care about that you feel like aren't being addressed?
Well, we need to get something with health care. Canada does it. Mexico does it. There's got to be some reason that these other countries can do it. Why can't we?
All right. Larry's a registered voter here. He's undecided. Could you give me your best 30-second pitch for his vote?
Absolutely. Okay, so Larry, I'm Emily, and I am with the Democratic Party.
Emily launched into Obama's health care plan. And when it was Camilla's turn, she went back to fuel prices and talked about the need for energy independence.
Energy independence. So hopefully your fuel bill doesn't stay at the price that it's at. It's going to take a comprehensive effort, and thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Any thoughts?
No thoughts.
Drive safely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Melvin headed back to his truck, his energy drink sweating from the heat. Camilla and Emily take off too, and I'm left standing in the sun, watching the truckers pour hundreds of dollars of diesel fuel into their tanks. In Phoenix, at the Liberty Fuel Travel Center, I'm Renee Cattell for Weekend America.
You can check out the big rigs and the guys whose job it is to drive them at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA program.
He committed murder. Then, not long ago, he was released. Follow him on his first weekend outside the prison yard in 20 years. Next on Weekend America. Thank you. It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe. Who decides whether a person sent to prison for life with the possibility of parole should get that parole? 20 years ago, voters in California gave that decision to the governor, and fewer than 1% of lifers eligible for parole were released. But things may be about to change. Last month, the court ruled that the governor has to have evidence that the prisoner is still a threat to the public. If not, and if the prisoner would otherwise be eligible for parole, the prisoner may be let out. That ruling becomes official today, and on Monday morning, the courts may start releasing dozens of lifers. That's already happened to one man serving a life sentence in San Quentin. Just days after the court's initial ruling, he was notified he was getting out. Nancy Mullane was there for his first weekend as a free man.
Standing over a prison sink, Philip J. Seiler is shaving his face for the last time behind bars.
Just shaving and getting ready to go see my family and friends. They're all waiting for me at home. Got a little party for me.
He's a tall man with slightly graying brown hair, snappy blue eyes, and a short mustache. He's so excited his hands are shaking. It all started with a fax his prison counselor handed him a few days before.
It's just a small little fax, and all it said was it was from the Board of Prison Terms to the warden. And it was the board was saying to release me.
Done shaving, he goes into a nearby office filled with armed guards. He has to wait for his parole officer to come and pick him up and take him home to his parents' house. After more than 2 decades in prison, he says he's got lots of patience. Now 47, he was just 27 when he shot and killed Charlie Horner, a man who he says was having an affair with his wife.
I just went berserk, started chasing him. They pulled over, we got out, we exchanged a few words, and I shot him.
After shooting Horner, Philip got back in his van, drove to his mother-in-law's house, called the police, and turned himself in.
Sat on the couch with my boys and I just held on to him, told him that I was going away for a long time, and I was sorry.
He was found guilty of murder and sentenced to 17 years to life in state prison, but with the possibility he could be paroled if he rehabilitated himself. So for the past 2 decades, Philip's been a model prisoner. He's taken college classes, joined organizations devoted to nonviolence, and talked to troubled teens. He says something's got to come out of a guy getting killed who didn't need to get killed.
The stuff that I do, that I've been doing for 21 years in prison, is in honor of Charlie.
Then a dark blue sedan pulls up. A parole officer in a Hawaiian shirt gets out of the car and walks over to Philip.
We're here to pick you up, sir. Okay.
Philip changes out of his prison blues and into street clothes and loads boxes full of letters and books he's saved over the years into the car. Meanwhile, about 100 miles away, family and friends wait and watch at the window of his parents' home. He called to tell them he was getting out, and now they're pacing the floor. There's deli sandwiches and chips, and Philip's favorite, a carrot cake, on the table. His mom, Shirley Seiler, is anxious. She says they've been cleaning the house from top to bottom for 2 days.
We want him to come home and see how good home is.
Suddenly, the front door opens. Everyone looks at Philip, stunned. His mom rushes to hug him, something she hasn't been able to do in more than 20 years.
It's over. They didn't appeal, so it's all over.
His stepfather and only sister and the girlfriend he met in prison take turns hugging and kissing him. His sons aren't there. They're both locked up in prison. After his parole agent leaves, they're overly careful not to do anything that could violate the terms of Philip's parole. So they fill plastic champagne flutes with non-alcoholic sparkling apple cider and toast.
Wow. This is a long overdue freedom.
Yes. Well, sir, get your glass in here, Jim.
All right. You got to touch Philip's glass.
To Philip.
Wow. Jeez, thank you.
I know. Where are you going to plug that?
I didn't shoot you really here.
So we don't want you to sit down. We're just
gonna, I don't think I can
we're
if
just
I
gonna
try.
Follow you yeah. wherever you float.
Then Philip pushes open the front door and takes a walk outside to test his new freedom.
You know what? These sidewalks, for some reason or another, are amazing me. Because we don't have sidewalks in prison. And it's just I forgot about sidewalks. I used to jump my bike on the you know, and you're walking by people's houses. It's just we didn't have them in prison, so.
But not everyone wanted Philip to get out of prison. Twice he was found suitable for release by the parole board. The victim's family didn't fight his release. But each time the governor reversed the board's decision, arguing that no matter how much rehabilitation Philip had done, his original crime was too heinous. Then late last month, the state Supreme Court ruled that wasn't a good enough reason. Instead, there has to be evidence the prisoner is still a threat. Otherwise, the governor has to release him. The day the court's ruling came down, Philip's case happened to be up for review, and so the governor ordered his parole. That doesn't sit well with Julie Garland.
You know, we're talking about murderers.
Garland is a senior assistant attorney general for the state of California and represented the governor before the Supreme Court. She argued in the name of public safety, the governor should have the final say over whether or not to parole someone.
There's obviously the possibility that they could commit another murder or another crime, but that is something that is very difficult to predict. And we had really hoped to keep that prediction in the hands of the governor.
On Saturday, his first weekend as a free man, Philip wants to spend the day at the state fair like he used to do when he was a kid. As we pull into the parking lot, he looks up at the new high-tech rides and their seat-like cages hanging in the air. He says the rides have changed, and maybe he'll just walk around.
My luck would be the ride that I got on, the car would fly off, and so I would get out of prison after 20 years and spend a week out and be dead. So I don't think I'm going to get on any rides.
But when he sees the huge 40-foot water slide, he can't resist. He says he loves water and hasn't had a good swim in a long time.
Man, I'm going to do that again. That was bad.
Soaking wet, he gets to his feet, a big smile on his face. Back on solid ground, he takes a seat on a picnic bench in the shade of some trees. He says the state won't regret letting him out. He's going to get his old job back as a plumber and spend time getting to know his family. But he thinks about the hundreds of lifers he left behind bars.
It's survivor's guilt. I mean, it's like being in war and going home safely and your partners are killed on the battlefield. It's like, you know, why me?
More inmates may be asking that question very soon. On Monday morning, courts across the state will begin processing the appeals of hundreds of lifers who have challenged the governor's decision to deny them parole. I'm Nancy Mullane for Weekend America.
We have a slideshow of Philip Seiler's first weekend home. That's at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA Program.
Former Poet Laureate Billy Collins on the poetic influence of Bugs and Daffy. To miss that segment would obviously be despicable. Ahead on Week in America. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. The presidential campaign is everywhere these days. I don't have to tell you that. Obama and McCain are making sure that we know what they think is really important as the election draws closer. But that should be a two-way conversation, don't you think? Between now and November, we're asking Americans for their takes on what's really important in this election. Alexandra Fuller is a writer in Jackson, Wyoming, but she grew up in a very different place. Well, sort of.
I was raised in an insular southern African country by a small colonial community for whom the mere idea of thinking bordered on an unnatural act. There was state censorship, media blackouts, and the complicit muting of ideas. History lessons were confined to rather dreary accounts of white explorers' victories in battle against nature and native people. Literature classes were limited to the study of works that were unlikely to raise uncomfortable questions about apartheid and inequality. The Rhodesian War ended in 1980, and schools were finally integrated. Books and music, regular fare in every other country in the world, Anne Frank's diary, Doris Lessing's The Grass is Singing, found their way into our hands. The result was incendiary. I felt as if I was a one-person revolution, a walking explosion of thoughts which at any moment might seep out and forever tarnish me in the eyes of my own still doggedly racist and unchanging white community. Then a couple of girls at school who had been in exile overseas during the war introduced us to an audio recording of Martin Luther King Jr. Someone else played us a Bob Marley album. After that, there was no end to the discoveries. Everything seemed equally radical to us. Bob Dylan, The Beatles, Jack Kerouac, Erica Jong, George Orwell, Chinua Achebe. Even Boy George, with his gender-defying looks and high plaintive voice, blew us away. The excitement of so much freedom of information falling on us in such a short time meant that we didn't have the opportunity to be cynical, apathetic teenagers. We were far too busy waking up. 20 years have passed. Now I live in Wyoming with my husband and three children. Writing about the West, and in particular the recent oil boom experienced by Wyoming, I found myself writing angry editorials about our failed energy policy. I was exercising my full and loud right to speech, but I wasn't listening. Without noticing it, a kind of middle-aged plaque had settled onto my thinking. Instead of an open mind, I had built up a self-protective shield of ironic liberal comebacks. My beliefs had calcified into unexamined prejudices. And then a year ago, unexpectedly, I found myself writing a true story about a Wyoming cowboy who had been killed on the oil rigs on Valentine's Day, 2006. Colton H. Bryant was 25 years old when he fell to his death, leaving behind a wife and two small children. In the strain to understand Colton, to understand who he was through interviews with his family and his best friend, I found myself for the first time in decades listening to a new voice. He was a hunter, a snowmobiler, a self-proclaimed redneck. In short, he resembled people I grew up with and whom I had spent most of my adult life attempting to grow away from. But telling his story, my self-protective layer of cynicism started to wear down, until I had to admit that my own soul had been exposed by this blue-eyed roughneck. I even went back to church, to the astonishment of myself and everyone who knows me well, and found myself literally on my knees, acknowledging the truth of communion, that we all, liberals and conservatives, roughnecks and writers, must share from the same loaf, drink from the same cup, breathe the same air. We all have souls in common. This shift in my thinking has been a gentler revolution than the one I experienced in freshly liberated Zimbabwe, but still a reminder that being exposed to fresh ideas is always life-changing, and that voting in line with the labels we have attached to ourselves, feminist, soccer mom, maverick, is less honest than voting with our souls.
Wyoming writer Alexandra Fuller. Join the conversation online at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. As a kid, Saturday morning means one thing: cartoons. Remember that quiet time just after sunrise, your parents are still asleep, you wake up early, maybe pour yourself a bowl of cereal, preferably one with sugar frosted in the name, turn on the tube, and get lost in a universe of the implausible. Billy Collins remembers. His Saturday mornings were built around the Looney Tunes characters from Warner Brothers. And before he was twice appointed U.S. Poet Laureate, before he'd won awards and written volumes of poetry, Billy Collins was just a boy sitting in front of a black and white TV on a Saturday morning.
You know, if you break it down on the blackboard, this whole thing about influence, you could say that there are, you know, direct influences, and those are the ones that come right from your own genre. So if you're a novelist, you're influenced by other novelists. If you're a painter, you're influenced by other painters, etc. And then perhaps more interesting are indirect influences, which have nothing to do with the fact that you're a painter or a writer, but they come from something outside your own genre. Daffy. He tears across the landscape, blabbering in lunatic flight, from those who would pluck his jet feathers, wring the stem of his neck, twist his yellow beak, flatten him under steamrollers. His brain is a gumball, and with it, he tears across the landscape, haywire, jabbering and amok, outdistancing clouds of dust.
What's the matter? Everything's upside down. Strange. Can't make heads or tails of things.
Maybe the indirect influences are more benign, because the direct influences, a poet, those transactions are always accompanied by jealousy. You know, you could even substitute the word jealousy for literary influence. Literary influence is what the professors call it in the classroom, but actually the emotional experience of it is envy. Writers would not be moved to emulation unless they were envious of previous writers. So the little propeller that drives creative work, you can't see it because it's under the water, the little propeller is jealousy, and that's what keeps the arts moving. But don't tell anybody. The opening theme to Looney Tunes' Merry Melody cartoons is kind of like a Star-Spangled Banner for a lot of children of my generation. You'd hear those opening notes, and the glockenspiel kind of cuts in there, adding some extra zaniness, and you would be brought to full attention because you knew that you were about to be treated by this world of animation that was so delightful and so different from the normal world in which you were plodding around as a kid, scraping your knees and getting into all sorts of trouble. Bugs. There he leans, cracking wise, biting his bright orange carrot, bugging the world. Speed demon, ventriloquist, and master of disguise, he is everywhere at once. Buck-toothed and spectacularly eared, he is armed with dynamite. He is the only one who really knows what's up.
What's up, Doc?
Poetry for me offers the highest degree of imaginative freedom of any genre of writing. Certainly, poetry is not bound to the kinds of laws that guide traditional fiction, such as, you know, chronology, plausibility, character development. You can't just have characters kind of streaming in and out of the novel, you know. But in poetry, you are free to jump around in time and space. You are free to slip from one dimension to another. Porky. Happy only when he is gardening alone, far from conversation and the terrible stammering, far from petunia, nag, and tease, just resting on a hoe, unembarrassed, as he contemplates the blue background of his flat world, a Zen pig. You know, all the characters bring out various sides to us. You know, I mean, Daffy Duck is sort of the manic, blabbering, fearless one, and Bugs Bunny is the clever, ironic, sardonic, wry, foxy, outwitting one. And Porky's a little pathetic. You know, he's the only one, as I pointed out, who's actually married, if that's the state that these characters are in. He's the only one with a partner, you know, a life partner, let's put it that way. Petunia, who's tends to be a nag. Strangely, there's one human in this whole thing, which is, you know, Elmer Fudd.
Be very quiet. I'm hunting rabbits.
Elmer. The mailbox in front of the neat cottage spells out the unfortunate name.
Wabbitwax.
This morning, the homebody is singing in his sunny kitchen.
Kill the wabbit, kill the wabbit, kill the wabbit. Kill the wabbit.
Dum-de-dum, waiting for the tea water to boil. Later, he will have his nap, the enormous pink head rolling on the pillow, dreaming again of the wabbit, the private carrot patch. Waiting by his bed is the shotgun and the ridiculous hat, for he is the human.
Oh, mighty hunter, 'twill be quite a task. How will you do it? Might I inquire to ask?
My influences now are coming more from all different sides. I find that I'm drifting away from subject matter. There's a satiric element to those cartoons. They were knocking pretension. The waiter in the French restaurant, the handsome bullfighter who takes himself very seriously, the morbid undertaker. All you need is Bugs Bunny to appear on the scene, and everything changes.
Poet Billy Collins, we've got videos on our site. Oh, yes, we do. Classics of the genre. We've got Bugs in What's Opera Doc, Daffy Duck in Duck Amuck. You know you want to see them again. WeekendAmerica.org. I grew up watching Saturday morning cartoons, just like Billy Collins there. Now, actually, watch sounds too passive. I worshipped at the altar of Saturday morning cartoons. I loved them truly and deeply. I would start getting excited about Saturday morning on about Wednesday afternoon. And yeah, I was all about Looney Tunes too, Daffy especially. I loved that psychotic duck. What I loved even more was the fact that I would watch Looney Tunes every week with my dad. Him with his coffee, me with a bowl of sugary cereal. Dad had great fondness for Wile E. Coyote, noble and hilarious in his persistence and futility. Right now, my son Charlie isn't listening to this program. He's watching Saturday morning cartoons. He loves them. But even when I can, I usually don't watch cartoons with my son. It's not that I don't want to spend time with Charlie. I desperately do. The problem is the cartoons that are on. Shows like Dinosaur King, Sonic X, something called Yu-Gi-Oh! 5Ds. My son devoutly follows this one show called Chaotic, and in it, these kids go back and forth between reality and an alternate universe where tribes of subterranean people fight or something. A lot of these shows are like this. Children forced to find their way in a magical world, monsters all over the place, big vigorous battles where no one gets killed but everyone gets terrified. Often there are collectible cards. But for the most part, the one thing the cartoons lack is grown-ups, and the cartoons are serious. There are no silly meta-jokes slipped in for parents the way Warner Brothers used to do, no literary or historical references. They don't make them like that anymore. Listen to me. They don't make them like that anymore. I miss out on this time with Charlie. I know it's wrong. I should bring out a couple of bowls of cereal and join him. I should let cartoons be for me what they are for him. I should adapt. I should stop wanting my world with my son to be a remake of the 1970s memory of time with my own dad, who has since passed away. Instead, I usually linger in a different room with my coffee. But this morning I heard chuckles from the other room. Charlie was watching the show Skunk Fu about a martial arts skunk. We sat side by side for a while, enjoying cartoon animals hilariously hurting each other. Then the serious cartoon started, and I came down here to host the show. For the last few weeks, we've been updating storms and hurricanes on our show, and thankfully, nothing of the sort to report this weekend. There is fun to be had across America. Here's Jeannie Yandel.
The landlocked state of Nebraska has endured countless attacks by roving bands of pirates who travel by scooter. Okay, not really. But Nebraska's creating its own bandit raid anyway with the Midland Pirate Festival in Bellevue. Meet Blackbeard and Captain Hook and attend a pirate-themed wedding. 81, warm and sunny, so see which scurvy dog invents cut-off shorts first. Finally, there's a place for you to rock out on that flute that you haven't touched since junior high band. Flute Quest is happening in Bothell, Washington. Join in the Flute Circle, the Didgeridoo Jam, or the Hand Drum Circle. Wait, the Hand Drum Circle? Partly sunny in 68, which is a great temperature for flutes, and for the bagpipers who will play in protest that there's a Didgeridoo Jam and not a bagpipe jam. Perhaps the phrases dining al fresco and gushing oil well don't work well together, but that's what's on tap at Ardmore, Oklahoma's Black Gold Festival. Sunny in 83 for street dancing, pet parade, and art exhibits, all with a gushing oil well nearby. Wisely, local match collectors have postponed their convention, and given current fuel prices, admission to the Black Gold Festival is $3,000. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
A job on a cruise ship offers free shuffleboard, chance to mingle, solitude, vomit advisories, and a chance to be seen as a mute sex widget. Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This weekend, seven cruise ships are leaving from U.S. ports. Megyn Kelly is on one of them, but she's not paying for it. She's getting paid. Megan's a comedy writer and performer from Los Angeles. Earlier this year, she spent 3 months entertaining on a cruise ship from L.A. to Mexico, part of an improv comedy troupe. As part of our series Weekend Shift, we asked Megyn to take us on board her workplace.
Hey, it's the blow-up doll. It's the blow-up doll. Look, it's the blow-up doll. A table of hard-partying 50-somethings yell at me. The night before,
I played a blow-up doll on stage as part of a comedy show. Someone else wrote the part. I hate it. I have to contort my mouth into a gross receptacle and stand still, like a mute sex widget, for 3 minutes. They love it. They're thrilled to see me again. Do the face! Do the face! I've been offered cruise ship gigs many times. I always had a reason to turn them down. After all, I live in L.A. Things are happening. But all of a sudden, nothing was happening. I was temping at an office, and my social life seemed to revolve around my friends' babies. So, let's go on a cruise. About 3,000 passengers board the ship each week. They sign a contract swearing they have not had sudden vomiting or diarrhea in the past 24 hours. Cruise ships can be petri dishes for disease. Hand sanitizer is everywhere. We float out to sea, led by a nice, large Swedish captain.
Anyhow, we have an absolutely fantastic day, haven't we? Sunshine, no waves or anything.
People line up at the buffet, pour coffee, wolf down Eggs Benedict. He talks about the Norwalk virus, a potentially fatal bug that's spread by dirty hands. Oh, that's what that contract was about. If you have an accident, you vomit, he says, or you see someone else has vomited, call reception, tell them about the vomit. No one stops eating. No one ever stops eating. Day 2 and 3 of the cruise are sea days. They're mostly the same. Eat as much as possible, dessert in triplicate, waste time. Day 4, we stop in Acapulco. Guys in fake mustaches, sombreros, and bright ponchos pose with passengers for Welcome to Mexico photos. The passengers don't realize these are two Filipino guys from the ship's jazz band in costume. Me and some of the other actors go off to the local square, aiming for something non-touristy. The trees are beautiful and old. The square is old. We're the only people from the ship. Then it gets aggressively non-touristy. Quite a few local people are drunk and asleep. Then comes a short indigenous woman in no shoes with an exposed breast and a baby attached to it. She waves cheap souvenirs in our faces. We say, no gracias. She responds with disgust. The poverty is upsetting. I get back to the ship. Back on board, the bars are full. They're decorated like theme parks. Asian, Irish, Sinatra. I go to the crew bar. In a separate part of the ship, no passengers allowed. The crew has a weird caste system. We're in the entertainer caste. We get rooms like the passengers. We can eat in the restaurants. We can get as drunk as we want. And in the crew bar, drinks cost a dollar. Beneath us is everyone else. That's about 1,000 people, most from poorer countries. The waiters, cooks, room stewards, casino people, engineers, and on and on. They can't use passenger elevators or eat in the restaurants. They'll get left at the next port if they fail a breathalyzer test. They have to stay below decks in tiny beige rooms with roommates, names printed and slid into metal frames on the doors like filing cabinets. I make friends with the tiny dancers, tiny because they get weighed regularly. The girl who is my height is expected to be the weight I was as a freshman in high school. Guilt sets in addition to monotony. Suddenly, it's the last night of the cruise. At this point, passengers seem creepy. Everyone looks obese. All of these warehoused, anonymous people are having this prepackaged, anonymous vacation. Even some of them are sick of it. On the way to my cabin, I see a middle-aged couple. They don't notice me coming down the hallway. Her hair and makeup are fresh. They both look pleased and vaguely shy, like they're doing something very special. They both wear their version of elegant. She's got on low heels and a sparkly dress that covers her upper arms, like hundreds of other passengers. He's nondescript in glasses and a suit with a red tie, like hundreds of other passengers. They talk quietly as the door clicks shut. You got your purse? Yeah, room key. He pats his coat pocket. He says, you look beautiful, and she says, thank you. And he gently touches her lower back, and then they hold hands. They're so happy. It's proof that these anonymous people love each other. And I wish I were one of them. The next day, the cruise ends. All the passengers leave. They are free. They make their way to their cars, go back to lives where they cook for themselves, use their cell phones and their legs. I have to be back on board in a few hours for a new batch of passengers. Oh, they will love the blow-up doll.
Megyn Kelly is currently plying her comic trade on a different cruise ship heading from New York to the Caribbean tomorrow. You can see pictures of the cruise life on our website, weekendamerica.org. By the way, if you have never read David Foster Wallace's essay on cruise ships, do yourself a favor, give yourself a treat, and read A Master Writer at Work. It's called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. Here's a short passage. I have been the object of over 1,500 professional smiles. I have burned and peeled twice. I have shot skeet at the sky. Is this enough? At the time, it didn't seem like enough. Well, as was the case with anyone who's read his work, we were stunned and saddened when Wallace took his own life last weekend after a long struggle with depression. You've probably heard remembrances and eulogies for him by now, and we won't provide any more of that here. I'll just urge you to go read some of his work. It's often hilarious. It's usually fascinating. It's always brilliant. So much for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. You can download a free podcast of this entire program at weekendamerica.org. That way you could pop it into your iPod, take it with you throughout the week. You can have a little bit of Saturday and Sunday as you slog through Tuesday. Get out there and enjoy your weekend. Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Take a look around your streets. How has your neighborhood changed? I'm John Moe. On the next Weekend America, explore one suburb from its birth 50 years ago to today.
When my husband and I saw this model, he said this was the house we wanted. As cheap as it was, when we were signing those papers, our hands were shaking. Oh, we're going to be able to make the payments.
We travel to the former Levittown to explore suburbia, where it's been and where it's going. Join us.